Hey, Notorious Bakersfield fans. Notorious Bakersfield the book is available for purchase. If you enjoyed this podcast, you'll love the book. Notorious Bakersfield the book dives deeper into the most infamous crimes, incidents, and personalities that have shaped Bakersfield. This literary adaptation uncovers 30 astonishing true stories from Bakersfield and Kern counties last century. Notorious stories from a notorious community. To purchase your copy, go to Amazon.com or your Amazon app and search for Notorious Bakersfield, the book. This is the Notorious Bakersfield podcast. I'm Robert Peterson, the host and creator of this podcast that takes a look back at some of Bakersfield's most notorious crimes, events, and characters. Tina Blunt was employed by SkyWest Airlines. In the early hours of Wednesday, March 31st, 1999, Tina departed from her residence in South Bakersfield to drive to the Old Meadows Field Airport in Bakersfield. The first indication of trouble arose approximately 40 minutes later when Tina's boyfriend received a call from one of her co-workers stating that Tina hadn't arrived at work. The events that transpired in the following days, weeks, months, and even up to today have been gut-wrenching for her family. This week marks the 25th anniversary of this horrific tragedy from Bakersfield's past. This is Remembering Tina Blunt. In 1999, 31-year-old Tina Blunt was living in the 2600 block of Connie Avenue in South Bakersfield. She lived with her parents, her fiancé, Jerry Kernut, and her two children, her 16-year-old son, Randy, and her 13-year-old daughter, Jessica. Tina was a lifelong resident of Bakersfield. She graduated from South High School in 1987. She had a passion for collecting anything with Mickey Mouse. She was a longtime employee of SkyWest Airline at Meadows Field Airport. As with most people, her employment occupied a significant amount of her life. But when she wasn't working, Tina spent time with her family and fiancé. This is Gino Gallego, a co-worker of Tina's. Here's how he describes Tina and what she was like to work with.
I started working at SkyWest back in 1997. And so I worked with Tina from 97, from when I was a new hire. She had already been there, kind of established. I'm not sure when she started, but she was definitely one of the more senior agents. The one thing great about Tina is she's one of the first ones when I did join the crew that made the transition for me so easy because of her personality. One thing you got to know about Tina, she's one of the most fun and fun-loving people you'll ever meet. There was just no hesitation when it came to accepting me as part of the crew. It's just that, oh, you're here now? Well, guess what? You know, we're going to have a good time. So that's the one thing I remember. She always had this huge smile on her face. And Tina's a short gal, you know. She's probably 5 feet tall at the most. Just a bundle of energy. She had this, at the time, I'm not sure if her hair color changed, but she had this kind of auburn, kind of reddish hair. You were running down the tarmac, and hair would be bouncing all over the place. And, she like a firecracker. That was the great part about seeing Tina every day. I worked mornings with Tina, pretty young at the time. I think I was only 21. We'd have to show up at 4 in the morning for the first flight out at 5. I overslept, and I was a new dad, had a baby at home. We would you know, work hard and party even harder at night. And then you'd think you'd just be able to just pop up, which I normally could, but I must have rocked too hard the night before. And there was no such thing as cell phones, pagers maybe, but I mean, you'd be lucky to have a pager. If your phone wasn't close to you, they didn't know your phone number at home, you'd sleep right through your shift. And I remember waking up and hustling to the airport. I got there about 45 minutes late. The passengers were already walking to the airplane. And I see the look on Tina's face. And instead of this look of like anger, she had this huge smile on her face. And she was like, "Ooh, you're going to be in trouble." And I was like, "Oh my God, I don't even want to be here right now." She was like, "Nah, it's going to be fine. I covered for you." And Tina, and I mentioned before, she's a small gal, but she threw bags like a dude. An average load would be about 2,500 pounds. And that's why you needed two people. And so usually it was myself and Tina or Tina and another person. Somebody would be inside the airplane and somebody would be on the bag cart throwing up bags. And the first time I was inside the airplane, I couldn't keep up with her. She just kept throwing bags at me. And it was just luggage after box after box. And I'm thinking to myself, she had to load that entire airplane by herself that morning because I wasn't there. And, you know, and so I thought she was just going to rip me a new one. But no, she had this big smile on her face. Yeah, that's what I loved about Tina. She was just so easygoing. You know, nothing really could faze her. Those little airplanes at the time, back in the 90s, they were propeller airplanes, and they weren't like these jets that we fly now. And you could get into some trouble. And so Tina was my trainer, too. So we would have to hook up the ground power unit behind the propeller of the aircraft. So what you'd have to do is you'd have to take your hand, you have to put it on the wing and then walk down behind the propeller so you could plug in the ground power unit. And I'm looking at her, I'm going, "I'm not doing that." She goes, "Come on, just get in there and do it. Come with me." And the first time I did it, I swear I thought I was gonna walk right into that prop. And she was like, "No, it's gonna be fine. She's just so brave, and it's like nothing could faze her. And so I said, "Well, if she can do it, I can do it." It was impossible not to have fun with that crew that we had. We all helped each other out, and Tina was a big part of that, making sure that everybody was safe, but at the same time have fun, because it was a hard gig.
On March 29th, 1999, Tina threw a surprise 13th birthday party for her daughter. They celebrated Jessica's birthday a day early because she was going to spend the week of spring break with her father in the Los Angeles area. Here's Tina's daughter telling me about that trip.
It was like Easter break, and I had to go to my dad's in LA, and she drove me to the Grapevine, which was halfway. We met my dad, and then I went to my dad's, and then that was it.
So the day after this birthday party, Tina drove Jessica halfway to Los Angeles to rendezvous with Jessica's dad. The day after that, Wednesday, March 31st, Tina woke up around 3 a.m. for work, which was typical. She had to be up early for her morning shift at SkyWest Airline. To make it on time for work, Tina had to leave her house at 3:30 a.m. to get to the airport for her 4 a.m. shift. According to her fiancé, that's when Tina left. He watched her walk out the door. He heard her Blazer's engine start up and drive away. Then about 4:10 a.m., a co-worker of Tina's called Jerry, her fiancé. This colleague of Tina's was calling, wondering where Tina was. Jerry told this person that she'd already left and would probably be there shortly. But about 10 minutes later, Jerry gets a second call from Tina's work. She still hadn't arrived for her shift. Jerry thought perhaps she had car trouble on her way, so he got in his pickup and drove the route he believed she'd take. It's about a 9.5 to 10 mile drive from Coney Avenue to the old Meadowsfield Airport. Jerry got to the airport, but didn't see Tina's maroon Blazer in the parking lot. He went inside the terminal to see if any of Tina's co-workers had heard from her. And they hadn't. Jerry went back to the Connie Avenue address to see if she went back home. When Jerry didn't find her there, he called the police immediately to report her missing.
I worked the night shift that night. I had transitioned from the morning to working the overnights. So we wouldn't see each other because by the time I was done cleaning the aircraft and making sure it was ready for the next shift in the morning, there was a gap between about 1:30 or 2 a.m. till 4 o'clock where there was nobody at the airport at the time, just security. I remember getting a phone call right around 5:30. The flight had already left because our first flight's out at 5 a.m. So I knew Tina had to be at work by 4. Her and our other friend Angel, I believe, were working that day. And I remember getting a call from Angel. And it was the strangest phone call because he said, "Is Tina there with you?" And I thought to myself, why would you be asking me this question? You know, it's such an odd question. I said, "No, it's just myself, my wife, my child here at my house." He goes, "Are you sure?" And she says, "Well, Tina's missing." And I said, "What?" And he said, "She didn't show up for work and nobody can find her." And I said, "Well, that doesn't sound right. Let me start calling the hospitals." And so that's what I did that morning. I called every hospital. And back then you still had to get the yellow pages or the white pages. And it was a process. And I remember calling AMC and Memorial. When I got to Memorial, somebody said, "You know, you're not the first person that's called us about Tina Blunt. You know, we were getting numerous calls for Tina." And so I called our other friends. I called them up and I said, "Hey, you know, Tina's missing. We got to go down there because I know my shift didn't start till 1 p.m. And so that day, it seems like a lifetime ago, but at the same time, I remember it like yesterday. It was just one of the most jarring things to happen because you never think that it could happen to anybody you know.
Tina Blunt's disappearance shocked not only those who knew her, but the entire Bakersfield community. Here was a 31-year-old mother to two teenagers doing what thousands of other Bakersfield residents do every single day, going to work, and she mysteriously vanished without a clue as to what may have happened. Tina's supervisor said she'd never been late or missed a shift. Everyone who knew Tina knew foul play must be involved. Naturally, Jessica's father and grandmother didn't want to upset the young teenager until they had some answers themselves. But after this ordeal drug on for several days, they had to eventually tell Jessica her mother was missing.
My dad had to work, so I was staying with my grandma, and I kept telling my grandma that I wanted to call my mom, and my grandma knew what was going on, but she let me call my mom anyways, and I couldn't get a hold of her. And then 2 days later, my dad sat me down and told me that my mom had been missing for 3 days. They just kept telling me she never made it to work. He said he had been in Bakersfield looking for her the whole time when I thought he was at work. And that's why I was staying at my grandma's.
Jessica's dad drove her back to Bakersfield. This is how Jessica described the scene when they arrived at the Connie Avenue house.
There was all kinds of people there. There was the news people that are there. We had a couple of cops there, a bunch of family friends. My mom's brothers had came down from out of town. It was very chaos. I mean, all I wanted to see was my brother and my grandparents. I mean, I didn't know what was going on. I had a lot of questions and just still kind of was trying to figure out, you know, like, how could this happen? I've only been gone for 3 days and I come back to a house that has no mom.
Bakersfield police weren't the only ones searching for Tina. So were her colleagues at SkyWest Airline. They organized their own searches.
We hopped into cars and we took every possible route from her house to Meadowsfield. And, you know, we would all take our different routes and then we would all wait for each other and end up at Meadowsfield and say, okay, well, what did you see? Where did you go? All right, let's do it again. Let's waste this tank of gas and go around to the point of exhaustion. And then, you know, all right, let's ask more people. Let's ask the rental car people. Let's ask the janitors. You know, let's ask the people down at FedEx that work on Airport Drive. Let's see if they've seen this car. Let's see if they've seen this, you know, this person.
The first break in Tina's case came on Good Friday, April 2nd, 2 days after her disappearance. Her 1993 maroon Chevy Blazer was found in the 5500 block of Dunsmere Road, just off of California Avenue near Stockdale Highway. Here's Gino telling me about another one of Tina's co-workers crossing paths with the police while searching for Tina's car.
Candy was a gentleman that we worked with, too, as part of the crew. He was the one that stumbled upon the car. He was driving around and he stumbled upon her maroon car. And he was telling me the story, and he said, you know, I seen her car, and I said, oh gosh, that looks like Tina's car, because the color stands out. It's a maroon car. He walks up to it and he's looking inside, and he says he thought he saw a blanket. And he was about to put his hands on the glass is when BPD came out of the bushes, basically, as Abby said it, and said, hey, you know, who are you? Don't touch that car. What are you doing here? And this and that. And that's when he identified himself as, oh, you know, I'm this and this. I work with Tina. We've been looking for this car. And so he says, oh, well, they were staking it out. And when he came back, man, he was so shook that day, that morning. And he said, I found her car. I found her car. I'm like, oh, did you call the cops? He goes, the cops were there. He goes, they kept me for a little bit. And I said, oh, my goodness.
After Tina's vehicle was found, police told the media it revealed no evidence of a struggle or foul play, but they maintained her disappearance was still considered suspicious. Investigators disclosed that they had administered polygraph tests or lie detector tests to several individuals associated with Tina. They declined to identify any of those individuals, but did say they were friends, acquaintances, and co-workers of Tina's. Jerry Kernut, Tina's fiancé, told the Bakersfield Californian that he was one of the ones tested. The search for Tina Blunt ended on April 14th, 2 weeks after she went missing. Sadly, it ended when a man walking his dog on Bear Mountain Boulevard near Highway 99 discovered a decomposed body. Authorities disclosed that the clothing matched what Tina Blunt was wearing the morning she went missing. The case of Tina Blunt transformed from a missing person investigation into a homicide investigation. An autopsy later determined Tina had died as a result of suffocation.
When they found Tina's body, one of the crew members that we worked with said, hey, I know exactly where it is because my friend that works in law enforcement, he told me it's off of Bear Mountain Boulevard. Do we want to go? And so first we were all apprehensive and he said, you know what? Let's go. Let's honor Tina. Let's let her know that, you know, we cared about her and that she's not alone. You know, although she's gone, we want her family to know that she was a big part of our lives at the time.
There were some details law enforcement hadn't disclosed to Tina's family or the public. One of those details was photographic evidence retrieved from the Wells Fargo Bank on California Avenue, just a short distance from where Tina's vehicle was abandoned. The grainy photograph captured what appeared to be a male withdrawing money from Tina's bank account using her ATM card 45 minutes after she went missing. The person was wearing a white long-sleeved sweatshirt with the hoodie pulled up over their head. Evidently, this photograph is very poor quality, but it's a significant clue. The amount withdrawn was reportedly to be $140. Another important piece of this investigation detectives were keeping under wraps and not telling the public. They'd been communicating with a woman by phone. This anonymous woman called police while Tina was missing. The caller described the general area where Tina's body was dumped. She said it would be in the vicinity of the Grapevine, close to a truck stop, near a body of water. When Tina's body was ultimately discovered, the area matched that given by the anonymous tipster. Police didn't publicize those developments, but they kept investigating. In the months after Tina's death, authorities didn't say much publicly regarding the case, but Tina's loved ones did. They published quarter-page ads in the Bakersfield Californian offering a reward for information that led to an arrest and conviction in the case. SkyWest Airline, Tina's employer, offered a reward, as did her fiancé's employer and other organizations. The total amount offered by all of these entities reached $40,000 in reward money.
If they would ask me, who's your number one suspect? You got me, man. It's the one-armed man. I have no clue. And so amongst ourselves, when we were talking about, what was Tina into? Like, who did she know or where did she know? And we would just sit there. And we wouldn't have any answers to anybody. That's why it was such a perplexing. If only we had a clue, and if only there was somebody that stood out, none of us would be shy about pointing the finger. The only kind of thoughts that the friends that I had at the time, people that knew Tina and the crew that worked at the airport. The only certainty that we had jumped to, the only conclusion that we had jumped to, it had to be somebody that Tina had an association with in the past. And that's as far as we could get as far as reaching for suspects, because Tina was not the kind of person to, for lack of a better example, pick up a hitchhiker. For the events, as we were told, that happened, and I start to jump to conclusions myself, but I don't think it's far-fetched to believe that at one point or another, Tina had an association with the killer. What that association was, whether it was, a friendship, or whether it was just an acquaintance, or somebody that she knew, or somebody that she was around, that knew somebody that was close to her in her life, that's about as far as we got as far as speculating who did that. Because Tina, she was a brave gal, but she was also smart.
On the eve of the first anniversary of Tina Blunt's death, as her family and friends were preparing to mark the solemn occasion, police revealed a development. Detectives announced a 30-year-old man named Jeremy William Fender was the focus of the investigation. They refrained from naming him a suspect. They simply said Fender was the focus of the investigation. Police described Jeremy Fender's family as lifelong friends to Tina's family. After that surprise announcement from law enforcement, 1 year after Tina's death, months drug on without any significant updates regarding Tina's case. March 31st, 2001, the second anniversary of Tina's death, came and went without any announcement from investigators regarding the case. But about 2 months later, in late May 2001, more than 2 years into the investigation, the Bakersfield Police Department announced an important development. They finally announced an arrest had been made. The suspect charged with the murder of Tina Blunt was Jeremy Fender, the same person police named the year before as a focus of their investigation. With this announcement, authorities finally revealed that photographic evidence from Wells Fargo and the anonymous tipster detectives had been communicating with. It turns out the anonymous female caller was an aunt to the suspect, this Jeremy Fender. She was getting her information from Fender himself and calling police anonymously. Relatives of Tina Blunt's told the Bakersfield Californian that they were relieved a suspect was finally identified and arrested. On the flip side, the mother of Jeremy Fender, the suspect, maintained police had the wrong guy. It was revealed that Fender had drug and robbery convictions as a juvenile. At the time of his arrest, he was on probation for drug charges. Authorities and the media described Fender as a lifelong friend to the Blunt family. Jessica, Tina's daughter, said she didn't know who he was and had never seen him before, but she thought his grandparents were friends and neighbors to Tina's parents. While Fender wasn't a close associate of Tina's, he could best be described as someone she knew or was acquainted with. Police maintain the information Fender told his aunt that she subsequently relayed to detectives was information only the killer would know, or someone who got the information from the killer or killers. Remember, that information was that Tina's body was dumped towards the grapevine, near a pond or a body of water, close to a truck stop. And when her body was found off of Bear Mountain Boulevard, the vicinity matched that description. But here's the thing that struck me about this. It's all very vague, nothing specific. He didn't say it was off of Bear Mountain Boulevard. He didn't say it was off of 99 or I-5. He didn't name the truck stop, just said it was near a truck stop. These vague descriptions lacked any specific details. When police finally questioned Fender in person, they confronted him with this information. His defense was that he overheard these details from a conversation two men were having in a bar on Union Avenue, a bar named Vinny's. Fender said the men said they were hired to kill Tina by the father of her son. Fender claimed these two men said the father was behind on child support payments and he wanted to kill Tina. When investigators questioned these men and the father of Tina's son, they discovered they didn't know one another, and the father wasn't behind on his child support. That's when investigators focused on Fender himself as the suspect. Another reason police zeroed in on Fender was that out of six people who were given polygraph tests to, he was the only one who didn't pass. That information was revealed in the press. Law enforcement can use polygraph tests as investigatory tools, but they cannot be used as evidence in a trial. During Fender's last interview with detectives, what prompted his arrest was that he confessed to being present when Tina was killed. He denied being involved in the actual killing, but said he witnessed one man choke her while another man held her legs. After Fender told detectives that, they arrested him, charged him with kidnapping, robbery, and homicide.
Thank you.
Jeremy Fender went on trial in the summer of 2003, over 4 years after Tina was killed. The prosecution presented the jury with many conflicting statements Fender gave them. The assistant DA argued that Fender gave these statements to cover up his own role in her death. Fender's defense showed how a lot of information Fender had about Tina's death wasn't entirely top secret, as much as the team investigating Tina's case tried keeping that information out of the public. Some of it did get out. Also, when Fender admitted to being present when Tina was killed, that he witnessed a man choking or strangling her, his defense said he was lying. There was no evidence Tina was manually strangled. There were no broken bones to her neck. The expert witness acknowledged someone strangled didn't always have broken bones, but it was very common. But the biggest revelation presented during the trial in favor of Fender's innocence was the lack of any physical evidence linking him to the crime. Of all the evidence collected, DNA and fingerprints, none of it matched Jeremy Fender. After considering the evidence presented at trial, the jury acquitted Jeremy Fender. They concluded he was innocent of killing Tina Blunt.
I actually went to the trial. I was 14 or 15, I think, when that happened, and I was actually kind of excited that, you know, they had finally made a breaking point and arrested somebody, but then his stories weren't adding up and this and that, and then, you know, so I don't know. I kind of was disappointed after I had left the trial, thinking like, this isn't really going to go anywhere, because they didn't have anything on him.
You know, she used to call me Gino Cucino, you know, and so I'd walk up, Gino Cucino, how you doing? And I'm like, Tina. I was a shy guy back then, but Tina would bring it out of you. You know, Tina definitely would. I cherish those moments. But what I know for sure is that, you know, the world was just a sadder place when we did find out what happened to her, because she was a light. She was an energy that you wanted to be around.
You know, it's 25 years and it's been a long time, and I'm just trying to get some closure finally. It would be nice to close this chapter in our life. And I mean, I've moved on, my brother not so much, but it would be nice to, you know, at least get to the bottom of everything and just deal with the ending of this long, horrible story that we've been living for so long.
The Bakersfield Police Department lists Tina Blunt's case as unsolved on their website. I reached out to the department's public information officer to inquire if they had any updates regarding the case. The public information officer declined to give an update. If you have any information regarding this case, please call the Bakersfield Police Department at 661-327-7111. Resources used to research this story: the Bakersfield Californian and the interviews of Tina's daughter, Jessica, and her co-worker, Gino Gallego. Thank you to both Jessica and Gino. This is Robert Peterson. Thank you for listening to this episode. I'll be back next week, next Tuesday, with another notorious Bakersfield story. Until then, stay safe, stay out of trouble. Don't become a future episode of the Notorious Bakersfield podcast.
Just helping you out with your facts there.